This is the Environment Show. It's about our stewardship of the Earth and the beauty and mystery of life in all its forms. I'm Peter Burley. Coming up, a Nigerian oil spill reminds us of the troubled environmental history of that African nation. Much of what's been happening in Mexico's forests is governed by demand from international companies. Food and the environment, they're inseparable. We see what's cooking in one of the best restaurants in New Orleans. And on the Earth calendar, the sun disappears. It's the coming eclipse. These stories and more coming up on The Environment Show. You're listening to The Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. Mobile oil officials are trying to determine what caused an oil spill that sent 1.6 million gallons of crude oil in the waters off the coast of Nigeria in mid-January. It's the largest spill Mobil has ever had in the area. While company officials say most of the oil is not reaching the shoreline, marine wildlife and people living near the coastline are reportedly being adversely affected. The Environment Show's Stephen Westcott reports on how environmental devastation by major oil companies is nothing new in Nigeria.
On January 12th, a 24-inch underwater pipeline buckled in two places, sending light crude oil directly into the waters of the Gulf of Guinea. It's part of the Atlantic Ocean along the southeastern portion of Nigeria and Africa. Mobil officials say they still don't know what caused the spill, but say they are doing everything they can to clean it up. But Chris Springham, Mobil's manager of communications for Europe, Africa, and the Middle East, expects the effects of the spill to be minimal.
Well, really, in terms of animals and such, we're really only talking about marine and aquatic life because this was an offshore spill. So there was nothing, no impact inland whatsoever, neither from the rivers nor actually beyond the beaches. The independent assessments that we had, which have been conducted obviously in great detail over the last 2 weeks as we've been trying to monitor the effects, indicate that there really has been no long-term impact on marine and aquatic life.
Some of the animals and such that Springham is referring to are shellfish, fish, and waterfowl that are often destroyed during such spills. But Owens Wiwa, a native of Nigeria and student of environmental health at Johns Hopkins University, says reports he is receiving show the spill is already affecting mangrove areas on the coastline, which are critical spawning and nesting habitat for fish and birds.
The Mobile have said, from what I've read, that most of the toxins, you know, will expire to the air and will not get to people. That has not been the case because most of the mangroves, some of the mangroves along the shores are already dying. So if the mangroves should die, then you can imagine what will happen to people who eat the fish and also who drink fresh water that might be polluted by the pollution.
Spills like the one in Akwa Ibom can devastate tribes like the Abibio, which rely heavily on the waters for food. But Nigerians have experienced devastation from oil production for some time. Owens Wiwa is the brother of Ken Siro Wiwa, an internationally recognized playwright who returned to Nigeria and became a vocal opponent of the environmental damage he charged Shell Petroleum Development Company of Nigeria perpetrated for years. On November 10, 1995, Siro Wiwa was hanged by the dictatorship. His supporters say he was executed in part because of his opposition to Shell's exploitation of the land and his Ogoni people. Again, Owens Wiwa.
Shell has been drilling in our place, Ogoni, for the past 35 years. And there has been quite a lot of environmental problems. All spillages are not cleaned up at all, and vast areas of land will be destroyed by these spillages. Pipelines are laid on the surface in front of people's houses, and they are not buried as they are done here. Gas flares, gas was flared in very close proximity to villages, and the flaring was incomplete. So quite a lot of people were having a lot of respiratory diseases. All this was going on despite the complaints of the local people, and complaints of by the local people are met with brutality by the military, which is supported by Shell.
In addition, Wiwa says drinking water and groundwater supplies were contaminated by Shell oil spills that often went unnoticed. He says people couldn't plant food and fish populations were depleted from the greasy film. Before he was killed, Sira Wiwa complained to the World Council of Churches about the environmental degradation that was occurring in his country. The council did its own investigations and found that what Wiwa was saying was true. After his death, the council released its report. Dr. Deborah Robinson, a human rights advocate and former member of the organization, was among those who witnessed firsthand the problems in the area called Ogoniland.
And you have to understand that this is a very small area of Nigeria in the Niger Delta. In the Niger Delta, that's where the oil is. And the minority groups live in this oil-producing area. Since they are minority groups, they have very little power in the federal system that makes up Nigeria. So that Ogoniland and other oil-producing areas are some of the most poor and least developed.
Robinson says it's estimated that $30 billion of oil revenue has come from Ogoniland, but residents there still don't have electricity and running water. The Nigerian government does have regulations in place regarding oil drilling, but Robinson says the rules aren't enforced. Moreover, she says, the standards are below what would be acceptable in the U.S. and other countries. In a written response to the allegations made in this report, Shell Oil spokesman James Herbert admits that, quote, there have been some environmental problems and that the standards of the past are not the same as they are today, unquote. Shell says Sira Wiwa was hanged for his part in the murder of four Ogoni chiefs and says 15 years ago the company did purchase sidearms for members of the Nigerian police force deployed to protect Shell facilities. The company also admits to allowing pipelines to be placed on the surface of the land and says it is working to replace such lines. Lastly, Shell Oil says there are still some oil spills in Ogoniland which have not been cleaned up. The company says workers were forced to leave that part of the Niger Delta in 1993 because of violence. In the meantime, Owens Wiwa says the blame for what is happening in Nigeria is partly due to what happens across the Atlantic, especially because 50% of the exports from Nigeria come to the U.S.
The Nigerian oil that comes here is tainted with the blood of people. It deprives of our freedom and sends a lot of people out of the country as refugees due to the persecution that they face with the Nigerian military. The oil is a cost to us. We want to go back home to participate in the development of our country. As long as people here continue to buy oil from Shell and from companies that support military dictatorship, they are depriving us of that right.
For the Environment Show, I'm Stephen Westcott.
As forests in the United States run out of trees to log, some U.S. companies are looking to Mexico, where the government is passing new laws to attract foreign investment. In a continuing look at the forests of Mexico, Kent Patterson reports on how one big U.S. paper company has been embroiled in controversy south of the border.
Beginning about 100 years ago, U.S. companies began cutting trees in the northern Sierra Madres of Mexico and then shipping product by rail to the United States. The corporations were later expropriated during the 1910 revolution when Mexico embarked on a nationalist-oriented development course. But political winds shift, and recently, some U.S. firms have shown a renewed interest in the Chihuahua forests.
In junio del año pasado, un grupo de 13...
Maria Teresa Guerrero is an organizer with the Independent Chihuahua Commission in Solidarity and Defense of Human Rights, COSIDAC. She explains how indigenous landowners of the San Alonso community, or Ejido, came to her office in 1996 complaining of illegal timber harvesting on their land. The group then filed a complaint with Mexico's environmental attorney general, known as Profepa. They charged San Alonso's administrators with illegally harvesting an endangered tree species and small pines, partially in order to fulfill their contract with International Paper Company. PROFEPA later upheld sections of the complaint and ordered a halt to the logging.
¿En qué consistió la denuncia? Los campesinos...
The campesinos charged that there was excessive cutting of short green pine in order to supply a contract that had been signed between International Paper Company and the Ejido. There was an investigation done to see if this complaint would stand up. Sure enough, there had been illegal cutting. Pines were being cut outside the harvesting zones, and pines without markings were being cut. There were instances in which the regulations were being violated. All pines that are cut have to be within a certain area.
International Paper wasn't fined because the firm went through contractors. However, the company now says it stopped purchasing timber in Chihuahua. Spokesman Neil Lincoln claims the legal problems in San Alonso had little to do with the decision. Lincoln says the business was unprofitable at a time when the price of paper has dropped.
Well, we originally started that project in an effort to see if it would be financially feasible to provide fiber from that part of the world to some of our mills in the United States, and basically came to the conclusion that while there's a lot of potential there right now, it doesn't make economic sense.
But the San Alonso case was only one of several controversies involving International Paper in Mexico during the last 2 years. Another flap involved the passage of the 1997 forestry law. According to reports in the Mexican press, International Paper lobbied high officials of the Mexican government to initiate the new legislation. Spokesman Neil Lincoln says his company's activities have been exaggerated, but he adds that the paper processor views the forest reform as positive and is keeping experimental plots in Mexico. The new law gives tax breaks and subsidies to investors in large forest plantations.
Well, it provides the kinds of incentives necessary to get an industry started and the recognition that industrial forestry is an appropriate use of land. Those are two key factors that are critical to getting an industry like that started.
The 1997 legal reform is the culmination of a 15-year restructuring of the Mexican forestry industry. During this time, Mexican wood imports were allowed duty-free into the United States. Collectively owned ejidos were allowed to be privatized, and in order to compete in the international market, businesses rushed to modernize. But just prior to the signing of NAFTA 4 years ago, the industry was on the verge of collapse. Maria Teresa Guerrero.
O sea, México entra al Tratado de Libre Comercio con una desventaja muy grande.
Mexico went into the free trade agreement with a big disadvantage in terms of technology. We brought two things to the free trade agreement. One was cheap labor, and the other was natural resources. Because of this, our laws are changing to welcome foreign capital. Right now, our natural resources are up for grabs. In this case, the forest. Why is this? Because the ones that have an interest in our forests are the big companies. In this case, International Paper Company, which is the biggest landowner in the United States. They want to buy the forests with contracts to purchase secondary material, but they're also interested in plantations because they have to assure the supply of their raw material until 100 years from now.
Currently, some U.S. and Japanese corporations are testing the new legal and economic climate. Representatives of landowners' groups report sawmill operations being set up as far south as the states of Oaxaca and Guerrero. I'm Kent Patterson reporting.
This is The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. The Environment Show is a national production. Coverage of the Mexican forest is made possible by a grant from the Fund for Investigative Journalism and the KUNM Producers Fund. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Elton Jones Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, the Oliver S. and Jenny R. Donaldson Charitable Trust, the William Bingham Foundation, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby. 1-800-C-A-R-H-E-R-E.
Your view
views on the environment are important to us, we might even air them. Give us a call. The number is 1-888-49-GREEN. That's 1-888-49-GREEN. Reach us by email, green@wamc.org. That's green@wamc.org. Much of our personal environment is affected by what goes into our stomachs. Food defines how we feel, and how our food is produced defines the environment. One institution that affects both food producers and folks who savor outstanding cuisine is the Commander's Palace Restaurant in New Orleans. It's been voted the best restaurant in the United States for 3 years running by readers of the food and wine magazine James Beard House. Most customers dine in the formal dining rooms, where the menus feature dishes such as rabbit and quail. But one table is located in the kitchen itself. T. Martin, who runs the restaurant, says the kitchen table is for people who really care about what they eat.
Anybody can eat at this table. Anybody who is what we call a foodie, people who are into food, we tell people that if you don't like what you're hearing right now, you know, the noise and to be in the middle of all this chaos, that don't come eat at this table. But when you eat here, you eat what the chef is into that night. And he picks the meal for you, and nobody else in the restaurant is eating that meal. And it's usually many small courses, and it's extraordinary.
She says special care is taken to finding products that her battery of chefs work with.
We have the best food products, we think, in the country. And truly, Creole cuisine is America's only regional cuisine. It's only indigenous cuisine. And this food began here because of the wealth of products that we have, because it's so lush, and you've been here a few days, and it does rain a little bit. And the ground is so lush from the flooding of all the years, and also that we're surrounded by water with the Mississippi and the lakes and the Gulf and whatnot. So the food comes that we serve, everything's fresh, and it comes from the area, and we have really returned to that. It started about 20-something years ago, if not 30, where, you know, America got infatuated with canned food, I think, in the 50s, and that was a big deal. We thought that was exciting. Well, obviously, all that's history, and we really only cook. We get mushrooms from City Park, from this our City Park. Our chefs have this little hiding place. That's right. We go to swamps in the area. The chef has a fig tree in his neighborhood, and the kids bring him the fig tree. I mean, we get food from where we are, grown in this area.
Sous chef Cliff John, a 14-year veteran of the kitchen, traces the sources of supply.
We have, you know, a guy over there in Louisville, he raises our quail for us. Another guy raises fresh rabbits for us. We have a guy in Lafourche Parish right before Grand Isle who farm raises our redfish, which we're the only restaurant who has that. So it's just fresh ingredients that we try to combine the ingredients together, and you come up with winners and losers.
And is there a special local dish that you regard as the thing that you do best?
Well, when soft shells are in season, I think you can't beat the soft shell crab that we do here. Crab meat's in season, we do a nice seared crab cake, which is a really, really excellent dish. Right now we're running crawfish. We run the crawfish mock shoe, which is local ingredients like corn and okra and onions and peppers, with popcorn rice, which is a local Louisiana rice.
T. Martin says it's the relationship between the chefs and the producers that makes for extraordinary eating.
These guys get in their cars and drive down to Bouti and everywhere else in Louisiana that you've never heard of, and Mississippi and the surrounding states, and create relationships with these farmers and fishermen. And many of these people do special things just for us, and because they know that we can buy all that they make in some cases, depending on the product. And some people do things just for us or just for our family of restaurants. We have some other restaurants in our family's group. And that's the difference, because when we can talk to the man growing the hog about what he is feeding the hog, because we eventually figure out how that's going to affect the hog, it makes a huge difference. And you can't...
We're going to prepare it, right. And how we're going to present it and what flavors are going to go into it.
T says that it takes more than good product to produce that special New Orleans taste. She says Louisiana chefs take pride in sauces, stocks, and long cooking times that mine the flavor. Some say that environmental degradation will destroy our food supply. Before that time comes, the personal relationship between the grower and the chef can be the defining factor in both the environments of the farm and the gastrointestinal tract of the consumer. We've been visiting the kitchen at Commander's Palace Restaurant in New Orleans.
It's all held together with julienne potatoes, and you slowly fry it in a pan fry it, and it's going to get nice and crispy and crunchy. And we serve it with a lemon butter with tomatoes and capers.
And now it's time for the Earth calendar. On February 26th, the Earth's moon will pass between the Earth and the Sun, creating a solar eclipse. While man has witnessed solar eclipses since the beginning of time, Jeff Chester, astronomer and public affairs specialist at the U.S. Naval Observatory in Washington, D.C., says they are still extraordinary events.
One of the most remarkable coincidences that we have in all of nature is the fact that the sun is about 400 times larger than the moon, but it also happens to be 400 times further away than the moon. So by this pure quirk of nature, the apparent size of the disk of the moon and the apparent size of the disk of the sun as seen from the Earth are almost exactly the same. So this means that at certain times when things line up just properly, the moon can completely cover the disk of the sun and produce a total solar eclipse, which, to put it in an understatement, is probably the single most spectacular sight you can see in the natural world.
Chester says the peak viewing time in the U.S. will be about 1 p.m. Eastern Time, with the southernmost tip of Florida being the best spot for seeing the event. But to see the total eclipse, one must travel even farther south.
There will be certain people who will have the opportunity to see this. If you happen to be along the path of totality, which stretches roughly from the Galapagos Islands across Panama, the northern portions of Colombia, Venezuela, the islands of Aruba, Bonaire, Curacao, across the Gulf of Mexico, or across the Caribbean Sea, up to the islands of the Lesser Antilles, Montserrat, Antigua, Guadeloupe, and then out into the Atlantic Ocean. If you're anywhere along that path, you will see the total solar eclipse. If you are outside of that path, and depending again how far away you are from that particular path, you will see what we call a partial eclipse.
Chester says that along the eastern coast of the U.S., about 22% of the moon will cover the sun. But unless you're in an area where a total eclipse is occurring, viewing a solar eclipse with a naked eye can cause severe and irreparable damage. Chester says there are a couple of ways to safely view the event.
The simplest thing to do is to make what we call a pinhole projector. And basically what you do is take a shoebox or something like that glue a little piece of white paper at one end of the shoebox. At the other end, you cut out a one-inch square. And over that one-inch square, you tape a piece of aluminum foil that has a pinhole punched in it. And that pinhole will project a tiny image of the sun on the piece of paper, but you can watch the progress of the eclipse that way safely. That is the safest and easiest way to look at the partial phases of a solar eclipse. And it really doesn't cost you anything, and there's no risk of damaging your eye because you are looking away from the sun.
Telescopes fitted with proper filters can also be used to view eclipses. Chester says he's seen four and says he can understand why ancient people believed it was the end of the world. Today, we know that a solar eclipse isn't the end of the world. But if it was, viewing it from the Caribbean wouldn't be a bad way to go. Thanks for listening. This is The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. We'll be right back.
you want, the world is waiting for the sunrise. Every rose, yes, is covered with dew. How'd you get so lit up? Gosh, oh, get up. How did you get that size?
You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Still ahead, a large number of dolphins have died off the Cape Cod coast, and scientists are not sure why. We talk green about pesticides in schools. Are we poisoning our children? Author Myron Arms presents a portrait of an iceberg breaking up in the Arctic. Stay with us.
You're listening to The Environment Show. I'm Stephen Westcott. Scientists in Massachusetts are trying to figure out why a large number of dolphins are dying along the shores of Cape Cod. Mass strandings of dolphins are not uncommon events. But what makes this stranding different is its magnitude and the fact that two species are involved. Among those called to the scene of the die-off were members of the rehabilitation unit at the New England Aquarium in Boston.
What we know so far, and we're still basically collecting a lot of our numbers because things were pretty scattered and it's going to take us a little while to get all of these exactly right, is that a large group of Atlantic white-sided dolphins stranded along the coasts of an area of Cape Cod Bay. It's a small sub-bay centers in the town of Wellfleet. And over the course of about 2 to 3 days, probably more than 70, our count right now is about 78 animals total stranded. Of those, about 64 to 65 of them were probably white-sided dolphins. The rest were another species of dolphin called common dolphins.
That's Greg Early, associate scientist with the New England Aquarium. He says residents began reporting the dolphin strandings on January 29th.
And at that point, we were getting reports of small groups, anywhere half a dozen to a dozen animals, popping up in various locations around Wellfleet Bay. Some were beached up on shore, some were still swimming. And as we sort of responded to those reports, we began looking around the coast and found probably the bulk of the animals had stranded earlier than that in a much more remote and inaccessible area of the bay.
Early says while it is relatively easy for scientists to determine the cause of individual strandings, mass die-offs are more of a challenge. Parasites and other factors have been blamed for such strandings, but the reality is that scientists just don't know precisely why such strandings occur. However, Greg Early says there are some common denominators.
Those revolve around the very unusual topography of Cape Cod Bay in general and Wellfleet Bay in particular, number one. Number two, unusual storms, high tides, climatological events, and seasonal kind of events that occur, plus the social organization that sort of holds these groups together when they're out in the open ocean. in the context of a large group of animals trying to coordinate itself through a real difficult stretch of bay to navigate, we think a lot of those, a lot of the social organization that, that helps hold those groups together actually works against them and makes it harder for those for a whole big group of animals to navigate in and out of tight, stressful, difficult situations.
Strandings usually occur every year to year and a half and include one species at a time. What makes this die-off unique is that both white-sided and common dolphins are dying. More importantly, perhaps, the strandings seem to be occurring more frequently. Again, Greg Early.
If you go back to the early 70s, there were two large strandings of white-sided dolphins in 1973 and 1974, one in Wellfleet Bay, one up in Maine and another area where white-sided dolphins frequently mass strand. And at the time, that was that collection of two strandings in sort of 2 years was a pretty significant event. As a matter of fact, it was probably the first time there had been two strandings of that size of white-sided dolphins in probably two or three decades prior, and white-sided dolphins were not generally regarded as very common, and strandings of them were kind of unusual.
Early believes the increased number of dolphin die-offs could be caused by shifts in population and feeding behaviors. In the meantime, he says scientists are continuing to collect data and expects researchers to have better insight into this mass die-off in the coming weeks. For the Environment Show, I'm Stephen Westcott.
We're talking green, and I'm Peter Burley. We're going to be discussing a subject that has got to be of major concern to every parent in the United States, and that is the use of pesticides in schools. This is with the background that childhood cancer has increased about 10% in America between 1974 and 1991, and there's a growing body of research that says that some pesticides affect the human endocrine system and particularly with respect to children, at much lower levels than had previously been understood. And so, with that in mind, the California Public Interest Research Group, or CalPIRG, has recently released a study, which is a scorching report about the use of pesticides in California schools. So the question is, how safe are our schools? We'd like to hear from you as to what you think. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. And I have three very knowledgeable guests with me today. Jonathan Kaplan, he's the Toxic Programs Director for the California Public Interest Research Group. That's a nonprofit environmental organization. His branch is in California. Vita Federighi, who is Head of Communications for the California Department of Pesticide Regulation. And Andy Yazanowski, and he is Safety and Loss Control Manager for the San Bernardino County Superintendent's Office. So, welcome to all of you. We're Talking Green in the Environment Show. And Jonathan Kaplan, I'd like to start with you. You co-authored a study of pesticide use in California schools. Briefly, what did you find?
Well, Peter, let me just embellish on your background there before I give my findings. You mentioned that cancer rates among children are going up every year, and that is, of course, correct. We also know that pesticides have been directly linked with cancer in children. There's an emerging literature which suggests that household pesticide use increases childhood cancer several-fold. Soft tissue cancers are increased four-fold. Leukemias increase six-fold. These are risks of brain cancer also increased 2 to 5-fold. This is for household use of pesticides.
That I think is understood. The question is, what did you find as you conducted your study?
Well, we surveyed 46 school districts in California representing 1 in 4 of all school children in California, and we found that 87% of the school districts surveyed reported using what we've called highly toxic pesticides. Pesticides that appear on government agency lists for causing a certain health effect, such as cancer, reproductive toxicity, These are nerve toxins, and as you mentioned, endocrine-disrupting pesticides, or pesticides which disrupt the human hormone system. We also found that no one in California is really tracking school pesticide use, often including the schools themselves. We found that parents or teachers who want to find out about what's being used in their schools are going to be up against a brick wall, essentially. Schools are not required to report pesticide use. They're not required to track it. We got this information by sorting through receipts and invoices that schools had in their accounting files with contracts to pesticide applicators and for purchases of pesticides. Finally, we found that pesticide use in California really is the rule and not the exception. 93% of the schools surveyed reported using one or more pesticides, and a third of them, and this is very concerning, a third of them reported hiring pesticide applicators on a regular basis for what we call calendar spraying. That means they come in and spray once a month or once every 6 months, regardless of whether or not pests are present.
So, Jonathan, just to clarify this, though, what you found was that these substances are used. You didn't do studies that show their presence in the environment. Am I right about that?
That's exactly right.
Okay.
We were not able to make any kind of exposure assessment. Again, the quality of the record keeping is so poor that in many cases we weren't able to even assess the amount of pesticide used.
Okay. So, Vita Federici from the California Department of Pesticide Regulation. These pesticides are being used. I would assume you would agree. When you get down to it, how safe are the schools themselves?
We here in California and the U.S. EPA, we don't allow pesticides to be licensed for use unless they can be used safely in all the situations where they are licensed to be used, whether it's a school or a home or on a farm. We would agree.
Well, let me stop you there, though. But wouldn't you agree that even though it may be licensed, it can be applied and used in a way that would put humans at risk?
If it's misused, it can put people at risk.
Okay.
Not if it's used correctly. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, we wouldn't let it be used.
Yes.
Let me finish here. My point was that we would agree that schools should not be using pesticides on a calendar basis. We think that schools should be practicing what's called integrated pest management, which is basically a tailoring an approach for every school district. It's an approach to pest control that emphasizes preventing pests before they happen. And if you do have a pest problem, you use the least toxic method. That's why we've been working with school districts to try to get them to adopt IPM.
But just to clarify on that, whether they do or not is a question that's up to the district itself. Is that correct?
Yes, and we think that's only right.
Okay.
You know,
let's hear from Andy Yazanowski, who is, in fact, in a school district.
Sure.
What does your district use, and how have you guys approached this?
Actually, I provide services to 40 school and college districts in the county, so I'm not typically assigned to any one district. But my role as a safety and loss control manager is to guide districts into the most effective and the safest methods of things such as pest control. And I would agree wholeheartedly with Vita and also with Jonathan that integrated pest management is a thing that schools do need to look at very seriously. In the past, what we've had is a situation where the EPA and DPR have recommended IPM be implemented, but schools, I think, have not really grabbed a hold of that concept.
How many of the districts that are in your bailiwick are actually using IPM?
I haven't surveyed them formally, but I can tell you what we're going to be doing in the future. And I would probably venture a guess, that maybe 10 out of our 40 districts do have functional IPM programs.
Now, one of the things I heard Jonathan Kaplan saying is that a practice that occurs in some places is the calendar spraying, the pesticide applicator who shows up and does whatever they do, whether it's needed or not. Is that a practice that goes on in your district?
From what I've seen, and remember that each school district has its own board of trustees, its own administration, so we're in advisory capacity at the county superintendent of schools level. And from what I've seen, yes, I have seen that done at some districts. But remember that each school district has its own board, and they are a fully functioning separate entity apart from the county schools office. But what we are doing in the future and what we have been doing for the last 2 years is promoting IPM. As a matter of fact, we had just mailed out a request for qualifications last month to 67 companies in the county, and what we're going to be doing is pre-qualifying companies in this county for our 40 districts, and then sending out a request for proposal and selecting one vendor, one pest control operator that has a very good IPM record, has fully implemented IPM techniques with its own staff, and we're going to be hiring that company countywide and offering that to our districts as an option to participate. And
I think listeners will say, great, I'm hearing a lot about process, but how comfortable can I be with what's going on in a place where my child may spend a good part of every day? Vita, speaking for the state, are you pretty comfortable with the circumstances that our kids are in?
I think that this is a place that parents need to provide some impetus and energy. You know, in fact, the Natural Resources Defense Council had a report in last November called Children at Risk. And in its discussion of pesticides, it pointed out that in cases where school IPM policies have been adopted, the parents' roles as educators and advocates has been critical. IPM is not something that you can just legislate and implement. It's something that takes involvement of parents, teachers, administrators. It takes a commitment by the board to dedicate money to set up a program, to engage in more preventive maintenance. And so, and it has something that is, what is useful in the very humid coastal regions for IPM is not going to make it in the arid desert in California. And so because of that, you really need an innovative approach and an enthusiastic approach. And that's where parents need to take action. They need to go talk to their boards. I've been to many school board meetings, and parents are very vocal. And boards, because they're elected by the voters, listen to parents. And
okay, well, let me ask Jonathan something. What you're saying is the parents can be the moving factor here. Jonathan, I've got your study in front of me, and one of the things that you say is that when it comes to protecting our children's health from the use of pesticides in California, Governor Wilson and the California legislature get a failing grade. So your perspective is that the governor and the legislature ought to be doing more.
Yeah, I think it's a little unfair to just sort of push all of this over to the parents and say, you know, jump in and make sure the schools are doing the right thing. That's actually a pretty hard undertaking. Again, parents often can't even find out what pesticides are being used in their schools. I would suggest that the state, first of all, take leadership and eliminate the use of these most highly toxic pesticides in school flat out. There's really no justification for using known suspected carcinogens in our schools. I would also suggest that the state can do more in California to really help schools get these IPM programs up and running. I'm not sure what the current staffing is at DPR. I had a conversation with Jean Marie Pelletier, who's their chief deputy director, and she couldn't tell me how many people at DPR, how many staffers are trained for urban IPM, you know, who have expertise in that area. But it seems to me, I've only been able to find a couple staffers there who are experts on the subject, and there are, you know, over 7,000 schools in California, all of which, or many of which, need training.
Well, this raises an issue which goes, I think, far beyond California, and that is whether banning the use of the pesticides, which do contain certain toxics and so on, in schools should be done. Vita, you've told us that if the material is really bad, you will keep it off the market. Do you take the view that there should be any further banning of some pesticides in schools, the theory being that one could get equal protection from whatever it is we use the pesticides for, bugs, by other means?
I think the way to do it is to educate the users that there are other alternatives. But I think, you know, you can't just merely look at, you know, CalPERC, I think, failed to examine why a particular product might be needed and what alternatives might have been examined. The pest managers I've talked to in the districts say that before, they always look for least toxic alternatives, and before they can use something that's more toxic, they have to go to the director of environmental health or the district, talk to them, and work out when is the best time to use it, you know, in a very site-specific kind of way.
Well, you're describing a process that
That doesn't
I gather, Jonathan, you didn't find, at least
not
in
at
reading
all.
A report.
Not at all. Schools were hiring applicators who came in and sprayed chemicals that school managers often didn't even know about. When we asked schools what pesticides are using, they kind of often shook their heads and had to call up the local exterminator to ask, you know, what chemicals are being used here.
Well, that's why we announced back in December before this report came out that we are going to be setting up an IPM outreach program to schools. We're going to devote up to $100,000 and work with school districts because this is important to have their participation to see what's the best way we can get more IPM education and adoption by school districts. Because as Jonathan pointed out, there are more than 1,000 school districts in the state with more than 5 million students. But schools are a very difficult place for pest management. Unlike a farm where a few pests can be tolerated, no responsible teacher or principal is going to allow vermin in their classroom or cafeterias. And at the same time, schools are very hard-pressed for funds, and Andy probably can address this better, but, you know, so they tend to defer maintenance, and when you develop cracks and crevices, it provides entry points for pests. You have kids that are, you know, eating throughout the building and leaving.
Okay, we've just got a couple of seconds left. Andy, what do you want to see the schools in San Bernardino doing that they're not doing now to make this situation better?
I would think that schools need to take a real hard look at IPM. I think it's the thing of the future. I think that implementation of an IPM program is inevitable. It's just a matter of, at this point, guiding and coaxing school districts in California and around this country to implement IPM.
Okay. I'm afraid our time is up, and I know that, Jonathan, you probably would like to see much more aggressive action taken. We've been discussing pesticide use in schools. Are we being careful enough to protect our children? We want to know what you think. Give us a call. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. My guests have been Jonathan Kaplan from the California Public Interest Research Group, Vita Federici from the California Department of Pesticide Regulation, and Andy Jasinowski from the San Bernardino County area. And he is part of the management group there. We've been talking green, and I'm Peter Burley. Listen to the Environment Show anytime on your personal computer and respond to our survey. You can find it at our website, www.enn.com/envshow. That's www.enn.com/envshow. We all have places that are special to us. For some, it's a city street. For others, it's deep in the wilderness. For author Myron Arms, it's the Labrador coast in the Strait of Belle Isle, where icebergs are the size of apartment houses. In this portrait, Myron reads from his new book titled Riddle of the Ice, A Scientific Adventure into the Arctic.
July 7, Thursday afternoon. Position, Strait of Belle Isle. Until you've crossed the boundary of a major oceanic current, it may be impossible to appreciate the abrupt change in climate that such a boundary represents. The boundary of the Labrador Current is such a place. 50 kilometers to the west, the shores of the Gulf of St. Lawrence are covered with boreal forests and clad in summertime green, with winter snows and coastal fast ice long since melted and snow patches relegated to the highest mountain peaks. Then, within a span of 30 kilometers as you transit the Strait of Belle Isle, the water and air temperatures plummet, the tree line recedes inland, and the coastal bays and headlands take on a harsh Arctic appearance, with outcroppings of ancient Precambrian rock scattered over the Labrador Hills, and bogs of peat and Arctic tundra lining the Newfoundland shore. Snow patches appear everywhere along the beaches and in the crevices of hills. and in the eastern approaches to the strait, where the Labrador Current sweeps around in a great lazy eddy, dozens of icebergs dot the horizon, trapped in a cul-de-sac where they wander in circles among complex tidal currents. Just before noon, Brendan completes her transit of the Central Narrows and enters this area of bergy water. The number of icebergs visible around the horizon has grown with every kilometer. First 3, then 6, then 10, then 20 and more. An odd silence has come over the crew. The boat is under power, moving directly toward the largest of the bergs, a twin-towered monster that Mike and Blue first spotted earlier this morning. Amanda is at the helm. At 500 meters from the berg, she throttles back the engine. At 300 meters, she throttles back again and looks at me, waiting for a signal to proceed. Funny, I think. She and I are the only two people on board this summer who've ever been this close to an iceberg. Which also means that she and I are the only ones who understand just how deceiving these massive objects can be. They appear inert and profoundly stable. This one measures 30 to 40 meters tall and several hundred meters long. It is fronted on one end by a massive ice cliff, and on the other by a beach where the swell creates a long, curling surf. Gulls nest on the nearest peak. A pair of seals bask on the ice beach. Terns fish in the shallows where a fall of meltwater pours from a glittering promontory. Except for its color, the berg looks like an actual island, as fixed and permanent as any land. The difference, of course, is that this land is floating, balanced on a point of temporary equilibrium. Amanda knows what this can mean. Several years ago, when she last sailed to Labrador, she witnessed, with me, an iceberg of similar size literally destroy itself in a matter of minutes. Beginning with a single explosion, one section of the berg we were watching suddenly broke away and slid off into the sea. The entire mass then began to roll, trying to find a new point of equilibrium. As one visible portion began to sink, another that had been underwater began to rise several hundred meters away. Then, as can sometimes happen when a berg is rotten and full of shock faults, another section broke away, and another, in a paroxysm of explosive calvings that set up a series of tidal waves and echoed like cannonades against the shore. An iceberg that had only 10 minutes before been the size of a small office building proceeded to blow itself to pieces.
That was author Myron Arms reading from his book titled Riddle of the Ice, A Scientific Adventure into the Arctic. It's published by Anchor Books. Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. Don't bother seeing the Titanic movie again when you can watch icebergs blow apart before your mind's eye on the Environment Show. Call 1-888-49-GREEN and order show number 424. The Environment Show is a national production which is solely responsible for its content. Alan Shartok is executive producer. Stephen Westcott is producer. Steve Whateley is audio engineer with help from Rachel Phillips. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Packard Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J. M. Kaplan Fund, the Oliver S. and Jenny R. Charitable Trust, the William Bingham Foundation, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby, 1-800-C-A-R-H-E-R-E. Be good to the Earth and join us next week for the Environment Show.